Okay, good morning, and we're here with Johnny Ray Miller, who is an author of a book called When We're Singing, and it's the story of the Partridge Family and their music. Good morning, Johnny.
Good morning.
How are you? Rick Thompson here.
Hey, terrific. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy we finally got on. We solved the bug. I'm very interested in this book because growing up, David and I had a year apart in age. So when his show was on, you know, I enjoyed watching it and loved the music. But he wrote a book. It was a book about, I can't remember now, the Partridge Family and all the things that went on behind the scenes.
His book? Yeah. He wrote actually two versions of it. There was one that came out in 1994, I believe, and then it was revised some 10 years later.
Okay, this would have been the first one. And You know, I don't know in your book if... what I want to do first is let's get a little bio of you.
Okay.
So you were you're a native of Canton, Ohio.
Yeah, originally yes, and then pretty much I grew up at a place called Guilford Lake in Ohio, some 35 miles away from Canton, and that's kind of where all my roots are.
Okay, were you Canton, Ohio? I'm trying to think now. Are you a Yankee fan?
No. Everybody around the area, there's always the battle there of, you know, who you're going to be a fan of, and I was never part of that whole thing.
Never part of that whole thing. Okay. I see where you're a theater producer, an actor, and director.
How did that all start? I was heavily influenced by the Partridge Family when I was young, and it just seemed like something that, I don't know, I would look at that and think, you know, I could do this. This is something I could do. Mm-hmm. And it influenced just a ton of people who went into the entertainment business in one facet or another. And so for me, I went to school at Kent State, and I studied theater. And my focus was on acting originally, and then as you know how you do when you're in college, you just sort of do a little experimenting and you find things that you're good at, and you know, you sort of test the waves to see where you're going to fit in life. And so one of them was journalism, and I really liked that, but I stayed with theater, and I went on to do some theater. Then I did local community theater, and then after college, I got a job opportunity as an executive director, which was a rare opportunity for a college graduate in a small community theater. So at that point, all I wanted to do was be an actor. But I thought, this will be great. Save some money, sit down, and get myself rooted for a little bit, and then go pursue all of the acting stuff. But what ended up happening is that it just went so well that I just stayed and stayed, and I just kind of discovered that, you know, I had a little bit of a flair for that side of it as well, and it was kind of hard to leave. And eventually I did go and didn't want to have any regrets. And so I did some things. I went out to LA and did some things, and it was going good. But I don't know, I missed home at that point. I was a little older, and it just felt right to be here. I had roots here, and so I came back and took another job in another theater. Mm-hmm. That was a little more of a drive from where I was living, and it was that theater that I got the idea that I wondered, I wonder if I could get David Cassidy to come here. What a dream come true that would be. So that's what happened, and it's just talk about the right moments and the right time in life, and how that thing, whatever it is, that indescribable thing where things just start to piece together and go the way they're supposed to go, it just started to happen. And so David came, and we had an incredibly successful concert with him. He was very happy with what we had to offer there. We were sold out 3 weeks before the show, and so, you know, I felt like I had then forged a relationship with him that maybe could go on to be something else. And so at that point, that something else was my sliver of an idea in the back of my head that, as I always wished that somebody had written a book about the Partridge Family, especially the music, which had never been written about. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, I wonder if, you know, maybe I should be the one to try to do this. And so, again, I just kind of looked for the signs, and I thought, if I get Shirley Jones on board with this, I'll take it as a sign to keep going. And that's what happened. You know, it was like, I kind of describe it as a snowball that started with Shirley Jones, and then it rolls downhill, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so that's what happened. You know, before I knew it, I had talked to over 100 people and put several years of time into doing this, and everything just kept falling into place. And then in the end, David wrote the foreword for the book, which really, I mean, probably means more to me than anything else about it, because for him to, you know, put his stamp of approval on what I was doing was a big thing, when that was not something that he did very easily in life. So, yeah, that's kind of the story of, you know, my story that leads all the way up to this book.
Well, that's neat. You know, I see you did some work on different shows, and some of them were some of my favorite. And I just have to ask you one thing. I loved Cold Case and Without a Trace. How was Terry Hatcher to work with?
Oh, yeah.
She was always
great.
One.
Well, you know, I didn't have any lines, you know. I was there doing background work, and so
I could
it's funny
less.
That that you bring that up. Nobody has asked me too much about that, but it was a blast. It was a lot of fun. It runs in my mind. I remember that the Without a Trace shoot was a nighttime shoot, and so it started, at, you know, late, and they were shooting after dark, and it went all night long, and I just remember having a lot of fun hanging out with all of the people there, and what I had, my part in it was very simplistic, I don't know, it was just fun to be around that. And the Cold Case episode, what I remember about that was, this one's kind of funny, they needed people who could line dance. and I had had some dance background in college, you know, because I studied theater and I studied musical theater and all that. And I'm like, you know, I'm thinking I could do that, you know. So I called in for that. I forget how I got that, but I remember that that stuff was all shot, you know, on the studio sets. And that particular one, they put us, there was like, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 of us that were going to do this line dancing thing. And it took place in a bar, a quote-unquote bar, which was a set on the lot that was away from all of the stages where they were shooting the shows. So we got on this little tram, and we rode back into the lot somewhere. And I remember thinking just, you know, how amazing these lots were. They were really pretty big, and I didn't know where I was. It was like riding back into the woods somewhere. And so this little shack that was like a real shack is where they shot this bar scene. And I remember her sitting at the bar, and we were doing this line dancing thing behind her.
Oh, gosh.
That's about all there is to it. But it was another one of those deals where it was, I remember it being in the evening, I think, and I remember just laughing and carrying on, and the people that were working on these shows were really professional and really fun.
Sure.
And that whole experience that year was just, it was a lot of fun to go do that.
Cold Case and Without a Trace were two of my favorite shows, and I was really I loved both of those shows, but I never followed
great.
Desperate Housewives. But when Terry Hatcher was in Superman, I was like the girls that liked David Cassidy. I wanted to put a Superman costume on and go out there and fly away with her, but I always thought
she was the... I got to tell you, one of my favorite things that I did that year was Desperate Housewives, and it's funny you ask about her and that you liked her so much, because I was sitting right beside her in the one scene I did, in a jail scene where she comes to visit James Denton, who's in prison or jail or whatever, and I'm like sitting right next to her, so you know they do the shot several times over, and I got to talk with her a couple times, and she was fun. You know, she had this personality that was sort of big, and you know, she was the kind of personality that when she came into a room, you just couldn't miss her.
Right.
And she was very, very pretty, and you know, thin. They're all, you know, they're all thin. Even the guys in real life, yeah.
But I mean, it's nice when a actor or actress is also a nice person. Although I don't know if you we're going to get back to the book, but I don't know if you ever remember the Seinfeld episode she was in.
No.
Well, we'll have to talk about that when I see you up at the up in Lake George.
Oh yeah.
Because you'll die. I mean, if you haven't seen it, either that or go on YouTube and just type in Seinfeld Terry Hatcher. You'll die. But anyway.
That's funny. Yeah, I will.
Anyway, I want to get the book, and so you know, I'm looking forward to meeting you up there. But what is the book about? I see where it's the music from the show is loosely based on the Cowsills, who was another family band that had a lot of hits.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is comprehensive in that it covers the television show, how the show got launched, the backstage stories throughout the show with the cast and the producers. But the heavy launch in my book is about the music. There were, people don't often realize, there were 10 Partridge Family albums, 8 of them studio albums, and these 10 albums were released in a 4-year period.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, David Cassidy released 3 studio solo albums plus a live album plus a greatest hits album, all on Bell Records. In the course of 4 years, that's 15 albums in 4 years. Yeah. Who does that?
No, I know.
You know, I think that's really impressive. So that is a real thrust of what my book is about. And so I looked up the songwriters for all of the songs, the Wrecking Crew guys, the musicians who played on the albums, and I interviewed all of them, and the book contains an album-by-album and song-by-song commentary directly from the songwriters themselves. John Baylor, who was one of the background vocalists, was also a vocal arranger who put those background vocals together, and he worked closely with Wes Farrell, who produced the albums, and he put in probably 10 hours of time on the phone with me. He remembered everything about every album, and so the research on the music was really a lot of fun. And then on top of it, I live very close where I live. I don't live too far from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Really?
And so I was doing some library research, and they had some things that no one else in the entire country had. And I spent, I know, a good 6 months, once or twice a week, going up there and sitting in their archives and flipping through page after page after page, gathering up every piece of information I could get on the Partridge Family and David Cassidy during that particular era. And so all of that is in there. And it just kept going and going. I just kept finding all of this interesting stuff. So I did a little piece at the end of the book on Bell Records. I did a little piece on the album cover designs, the original designer. I found her who put all of the album cover jackets together, and she had a story behind every single one of those album designs, and I thought that was fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
So I put that in there.
Well,
so that's kind of like, you know, that's sort of what my book's all about.
Well, I can't wait to get it. I mean, I loved the first book that was about the Partridge Family, that, you know. And one fascinating thing in there that I mean, it was awesome, was that he would rehearse the show during the day, and they'd fly him out to do a concert that night.
Yeah.
Then they'd have to fly him back to do the show again the next day. And I guess he was one of the performers that made the most money from concerts, surpassing anybody that had done
concerts. Yeah, he was the highest paid entertainer on the planet in 1972. That's how busy he was. And, you know, the downside is, too, that it just took its toll on him, too. He was shooting all week long, and then he'd get on a plane on the weekends and fly somewhere, do concerts, and come back and have to know lines for the show during the week. So, yeah, that kind of schedule, I don't know how long you can do that without completely burning out.
Well,
burning
even when
out
you're young.
It.
I mean, you know, when you're young, it's usually you can do a lot more. But this this kid was on the go so much that and had so much pressure on him. You know, I think that's what led to a lot of later crisis in life. But, you know, that first book was so good. I try to buy it on eBay now. And, you know, they're selling for like $95, $105.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy.
Oh, it is. But you know what I think that goes to show is that the interest in David Cassidy is starting to come back since his death.
Oh, yeah.
That these people who are hanging on to these books are not taking advantage of his death, but they're taking advantage of the revival of people interested.
Oh, absolutely.
In him, you know?
Yeah, he had, I mean, this guy had a fan club that at one point surpassed the Beatles and Elvis. That's huge. And, you know, we're all still around.
Yeah.
And I think we're of the age, too, that it's becoming, I think it's really been important through the years. David always talked about how surprised he was and touched he was when he would do something, you know, through the decades, mm-hmm. and his fans were loyal and that they would always come out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think that's still true.
Well, I work at the track for 6 weeks in the summer, and, of course, David loved horses, and the first day he came up was like a family reunion after a couple of years, you know, me being in the same spot. Because I was in the box area right near his box. And the first day he'd come up and give a hug and you know, like we were old family.
Yeah.
But what I used to do, there were so many women that wanted to get their picture taken with him when they were the age that he was when the show was going on. And he was very cordial, very cordial, and always would have his picture taken with him up to the point where the races started, because that's what he was there for, basically. And I had to keep him from going down to his box, you know? And I think in some respects you feel good that people still love you that much. But on the other hand, it has to be a little bit of a pain, because you can't go anywhere without being fawned over. And I think that was his whole life. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, it's hard to imagine what that's like, to be that big of a celebrity and every day of your life to be approached about it. You know, I think unless you live it, you can't understand it.
Oh, exactly. You know, so much of the story's been told on TV documentaries. And does the book provide any new things about the show or the actors?
You mean my book?
Yes. Yeah, your book.
Yeah. Oh, your book. Yeah. Yes, it does. It's the thing about the Partridge Family and the actors on it was that it was one of these shows that had this chemistry offset as much as on. And so I wrote a lot about their relationships with each other and how they supported each other during this. And they all had different reasons to need support off the set. And Shirley Jones, you know, she was a real leader in terms of pulling everyone together. You know, this was a young cast of kids, mm-hmm. and she was the only one with experience other than Dave Madden. And she talks about how she did this in the very beginning, especially when the show launched. And, you know, when I would interview the cast, they would talk about how much they learned from her about show business and about how to carry themselves through show business, how to survive show business. She was strong and a big influence in all of their lives, in a way that was individual, mm-hmm. with relationships that she had with them individually, and with all of them on the set as a TV family. It was a show where everybody got along too. You know, it was a show where, and again, I think Shirley Jones had a lot to do with teaching them, you know, how to stick together and how hard it was going to be to endure the rough part of fame. There's a section of my book that I call The Real TV Family, and it talks all about that.
Well, that's neat. I mean, you know, Shirley Jones experienced something like that a little bit. I mean, she was a young actress who became very popular in films and on Broadway, and she was certainly a classy lady. You know, it's not hard to picture where she would be doing that with the younger actors, you know.
You know, Suzanne Crowe, you know, she passed away at age 52, which was shocking and tragic and sudden. She told me in one of our conversations several stories about little things that would come up when she would do an autograph show herself, or little things that she learned from Shirley along the way. She said Shirley was old Hollywood, and old Hollywood had a way of conducting themselves that is different than what it's evolved into nowadays. And, you know, she said that she always followed all of the things throughout her life when it came to the show business part of it, the way that Shirley had taught her.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, back then they had their own code of ethics. Now, things may have gone on behind the scenes, but when they were in public, they carried themselves in a way that made it very professional. And
very.
So I heard from a little birdie that you're going to turn the book into a documentary?
No, no, but I would love to. So you heard partially right. I don't have any kind of a deal, but I was approached a couple of times, and it hasn't gone anywhere, so I wouldn't want to get anybody's hopes up. But I would love for that to happen.
Well, let's make it.
You know,
deal.
It's.
I'll tell you what.
Let's make it happen.
I have a friend, and obviously you have connections in Hollywood or L.A., but I have a friend who was a producer of NYPD Blue, among other shows, and he was a retired New York City homicide detective, but he went to Hollywood and got into show business and knows quite a few people. So, you know, I mean, I think it would be a great documentary to do.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. And, you know, this is what I've been told along the way, especially since, you know, nothing has ever been told about this, the musical part of the Partridge Family. Mm-hmm. There's nothing has ever been written or told until now. And it's such a giant part of the Partridge Family story. You know, it was the part of the story that really only David knew everything about, because he was crossing over and doing both parts. He was there on the set doing the TV show, and then he was with in the studio and, you know, getting to know John and Tom Baylor and Ron Hicklin and Jackie Ward, who were the background vocalists, and then the Wrecking Crew guys, the musicians. He would hang out with them. He wanted to learn from them, and he from everything that I understand, you know, he just took information in, and he was a quick learner. And he could deliver very quickly what it was that they wanted. It's a really fascinating story of an unusual band. You know, here is a band that is real, but what you see on the TV show is something different. You know, it's the image of it.
Right.
And in the beginning, they didn't want anyone to know that they weren't singing. But very quickly, you know, but that the cast wasn't singing.
Sure.
Shirley Jones did. So David Cassidy and Shirley Jones are the only two that actually sang on the records. They mixed Shirley. They recorded her on a separate track, and they would mix her lower on the records, but then because she was on a separate track when they recorded the TV show, they could do close-ups of her and bring her track up some.
Okay.
So the sound that you hear on the TV show is mixed differently than the sound that was on the records. And this is all, I think this is just really fascinating stuff. And they were so loved by the public that, you know, I certainly don't think anybody cared that they were lip syncing.
Oh,
it was just such a great show.
Yeah.
And they were all so believable and lovable. And the idea that you could be part of a family that would be close and stick together and then go out on the road and have a recording career is a fantasy show that everybody wanted to live.
Right.
And one of the things that I like to talk about sometimes is in my interview with Paul Witt, who is now gone, he was one of the producers, and this was one of his very first shows, talked about how everybody has always said how unrealistic the Partridge Family is, but he said it really wasn't that unrealistic because the Cowsills were living it.
Yes.
You know, there were singing TV families, and this was a real thing. So, yes, it was a TV show that was fictional, but at the same time, it was rooted in something that was really going on.
Well, if you know, the success of the show, and when you said, you know, how successful it was, not only to young girls or teenage girls with David, but like I said, I was David's a year younger than David when he was doing the show, and I enjoyed the show.
Yeah.
So he had a broad appeal to different people. Now we've got like 2 minutes left, and if you want to do another podcast to get into some more of that information, I'd be glad to do it.
Oh sure, you know, I'd be happy to anytime
you're available
you want.
Next Saturday. I'll email you my phone number and we can pick a time. You know, I'd love to have you back on. There's so much to talk about.
But okay, terrific.
One last question I want to ask you. Did David get upset towards the end that he was doing so many pop songs and he wanted to be, he thought, taken more seriously?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it upset, but he was, you know, he was doing what a young artist typically does, which is that, you know, he was growing, and, you know, when you understand the evolution of art and being an artist of some kind, he was really a true artist. He could do so many things other than sing.
Mm-hmm.
He could act, you know, he could play several instruments. He was a songwriter. I mean, this guy was multi-talented, and I think those kind of people, I think they tire quickly of the beginnings, and they're ready to do something more and do something new.
Sure.
I've known, you know, friends of mine in the theater who are just so talented that's exactly, you know, they're just so talented that they're anxious to get their fingers into something new all of the time. And I think that was the case, you know. I think he wanted to grow, and I think it was happening, but it was really, it was almost impossible to jump out of that image that was built for him.
Sure.
It's, you know, kind of, I always kind of see it as this sort of catch-22 that he had to face. It was the thing that launched him
mm-hmm.
and got him out there and put him in the eyes of the public, but then it became the thing that he could not get past and
sure.
move on from, at least not at that time. I think he successfully did that as time wore on. I think his fans, all of his fans would probably agree with me on that, and I think that maybe he even succeeded at that more than he thought he did. I always think that he had succeeded in what he wanted to do throughout his life as an artist more than he actually thought that he did.
Yeah. Well, that happens a lot, too. I mean, I don't think
yeah.
a lot of performers don't realize how they touch people. either by meeting them or being on stage, being on television. You know, you gain a lot of respect the way David was. He was always very cordial to everybody.
Yeah,
so listen,
right.
We'll do another interview because you're fascinating. You're going to be signing books up at the King Neptune on the 19th from 6
yes.
to 11 p.m. So, but before we leave, I just want to make one statement to you because we're at the end of the show. If you do a documentary, I want you to get Terry Hatcher to play Shirley Jones's role, and I will be your... I will be your gopher, okay?
Anything you want, I love that. We'll have to put her in a blonde wig.
I will go for it, okay? So
that's great.
All right. Well, listen, you have a tremendous day. And watch,
you too.
Watch the Kentucky Derby today. And
yes.
Yeah, and have fun, and we'll be in touch because I want to get you on again. You sound like a fantastic guy, and I can't wait to meet you.
Oh, I can't wait to meet you, too. I'm anxious to come up and see the whole area and be part of this, the David Cassidy celebration. I think it's terrific.
It is. All right. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Johnny.
Oh, thanks, Rick.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.